Eric Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Mike Meese. He's the co-founder and campaign coordinator for the Buffalo Field Campaign. He spent the last 16 years living with and helping protect the sacred species of buffalo in the Yellowstone ecosystem. So why don't we start by talking about how... Well, first off, thank you for your work. And let's start by talking about how... I mean, I've read extraordinary accounts of how many bison there were prior to the European conquest.
Exactly. I think we all were taught in our history books, and this is one issue that they didn't really lie to us. We openly admit killing 30 to 60 million buffalo off continent North America. And as the onslaught of the conquerors, I like to call them, came to this continent and realized we were going to have to kill off all the Native Americans to instill our very warped idea of what success is, they realized that these warriors were way too good of fighters, and we weren't going to be able to just take them out with regular military. And so General Phil Sheridan, who was basically one of the big generals in charge of killing the Native Americans back in the day, was quoted as saying, "The buffalo killers are doing more to wipe out the Native Americans than any of our efforts combined, as they are taking away their commissary and their way of life." And so these animals existed from Canada to Mexico, basically all the way across the United States. And finally, I believe it was Roosevelt, went out to go on a buffalo hunt, and he couldn't find any animals. They were out for 11 days, and finally he came across what was thought to be the last of the species, 23 animals, and they were located in what is now known as Pelican Valley inside Yellowstone Park. So initially, to save this last little herd from the poachers, he sent out the U.S. Cavalry to protect them. And then the following 2 years, the National Park System was established, and Yellowstone was the first national park. And originally, it was set aside to protect the buffalo, and here we are 140 years later, killing them for the same basic, you know, excess of what I like to refer to as the holy cow taking over our continent in place of these sacred buffalo.
Well, I don't know if a lot of people will know what you're talking about with the bison being killed in Yellowstone. So let's back up. So Yellowstone was formed in whatever year, and there were however many buffalo, and then take it from there.
Okay, basically, so there were 23 animals, and they, you know, even back in those days, they were concerned about a genetic bottleneck, and so they looked to outside sources to help bring in more buffalo. And so basically, Mickey Pablo, who was from the Salish and Kootenai Reservation, kind of was a visionary of the time as well, and he saw this onslaught of the slaughter coming on, and he used to go out to the slaughter fields and collect orphan calves, and he started his own herd of pure buffalo. And when the parks started to show that they were going to do something to preserve and protect these buffalo for the long haul, he donated 21 animals. And then also from the herd down in Texas, which was also pure and established in the same routine, he sent up two more buffalo. So on the Bison Range, which is in the Lamar Valley, scientists took steps to bring in more into... But in that process, in the naivety of the day, they fed these animals domestic cow milk, and that got the disease brucellosis into the entire herd. Now, it's since spread into many other animals, and that's what this whole fight is about, is that the wildlife dare to spread this disease back to the holy cow. And so Montana has placed a zero-tolerance policy on bison coming out. When they do come out, they're either met with a gun from basically November 15th until mid-March, and the solution then is to shoot and kill every one of them. And unfortunately, they have roped in tribes, and they have a treaty hunt, and that's the only way the governments will recognize this treaty hunt is if they come and they kill the buffalo. And then after that, if they still buffalo coming out, they either round them up in the capture facilities, put them on, you know, 18-wheeler trucks, the big ones that you see hauling cattle across the country, and ship them to slaughterhouses. And then in a nice day, when they want to do a public relations thing, and this has started since we began our efforts here in the field, they do what they call hazing. And hazing, by definition, is moving something from where it wants to be to where you want it to be in a forceful fashion. And unfortunately, this happens to the buffalo after they've survived a very harsh, hard Montana winter. You're also looking at moms that are about to drop or have just dropped brand new babies, and their whole introduction to life is running from helicopters, ATVs, 4x4 trucks, horses, basically anything but their feet, and run up to 15 miles a day back inside the Yellowstone Park. And you know, what other species do we ever mess with brand new babies? I mean, it's an insult to say the least. And the worst part of it all is this is all being funded by us, the U.S. taxpayers, solely for the Montana livestock industry. So the whole U.S. taxpayer system is benefiting this one sole entity, and we think it's wrong, and we've been out in the field in their face, protesting, doing nonviolent direct action, doing anything we can to bring more attention and stop this atrocity happening to our last wild buffalo we have in the world. Another thing I think is real important to note is there are, well, first off, Yellowstone Park is not bison habitat. It's the last place they went to survive from being completely extinct. And their habitat is across America, and they're trying to write it that, you know, this is their habitat. This is where they would want to live. Well, none of the ungulates stay in Yellowstone Park. We have too severe of winters, and they migrate out to lower elevations to survive. And then the last important thing I think to note on this issue is that there are now 500,000 bison in the United States. You can find them in every state in the United States. You can even go to Golden Gate Park and see them there. But of those 500,000, less than 10,000 are genetically pure and not what we call beefalo. And you can't physically look at them and tell a difference, but it's their genetic makeup that makes some difference. So of these less than 10,000 that are genetically pure, the only ones that aren't caged in, domestically fed hay, and treated just like cattle are the Yellowstone herd. And now we're trying to domesticate them. And once again, why we think it's a hell of an atrocity.
So it would have been, so 500 years ago, the bison would have spent perhaps summers in, some bison would have spent summers in Montana, and then they may have gone how far south for the winter?
Oh, I mean, who knows? I mean, as far as Mexico, some of them. And, you know, that's the beauty of the bison and the buffalo is that we see the same herds walk through the same areas year after year after year. And they'll come through, they'll eat the grasses, spill the seeds, their hoofs are shaped as such that they retill the soil, and out the back end you have the magic fertilizer, and you have a perfect regeneration process. And they don't stay in one area and overgraze it. They're constantly migrating and moving and replanting. You know, it's like when we lost the buffalo, we lost the grassland prairies. And if we could bring the buffalo back, I guarantee you those grassland prairies would come back with them.
And aren't they also, aren't they fabulous for waterfowl too?
Oh, everything lives in harmony with them. I mean, their fur is used in nests.
And isn't there, didn't they help create, with their wallows, don't they help waterfowl habitat?
Exactly, and insects and bugs and all kinds of, I mean, they're just the keystone speaker of this species of this ecosystem. They, you know, when they go into an area and plow up all the snow and then move on, you'll watch the elk come in after them, the deer come in after them, because the work's been done to get through the thick winter snows, you know. And like you said, all the whole ecosystem is dependent on them through their activities. And, you know, that's what we fail to recognize is, well, not all of us as human species, that, you know, this little web of life was pretty well intact until we came into the picture and tried to commercialize and finance everything, you know. If we leave things alone, they kind of balance themselves out. We are the link that's a little messed up in the scenario. the animals are trying to teach us, but not many people listen.
Yeah. So the bison now have to winter in territory that is not really appropriate, and when they try to come out, they are either hazed back in or caught and killed. And the rationale for this is that they have this disease, brucellosis, that, like you said, they got through being given cow's milk in the first place. And what does brucellosis do to A, bison, B, cattle, and C, how is it transmitted?
Well, that's the other ironic thing is it's basically an aborted, affected fetus that's laying out in a grass field that is consumed by a vegetarian cow. Now, it's never happened in the wild from the bison, and the only time it has existed or ever transmitted was in a laboratory at Texas A&M, where essentially they put the disease on their nose and genitals three times a day, and guess what? They got it to transmit. Now, we also have a living life experiment, Teton National Parks, which abuts Yellowstone to the southern end, was only allowed to be open if they honored these old grandfather grazing allotments. So for the past 50-plus years, you have these quote-unquote diseased buffalo intermingling with these cows, and there's never been a case of transmission. Then the next problem we have, or the hypocrisy of this whole thing, is the elk habit. Now, the elk are a whole different ballgame. They have transmitted it to the point where they've made all three states surrounding Yellowstone, Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming, lose their brucellosis-free status in their cattle, which is what the big paranoia is, because it used to be aphis would, if there were two outbreaks within 1 year, your whole state lost their brucellosis-free status, your entire herd was euthanized or killed, and then, you know, you had to go through a testing process before you could regain your status. Well, now, because the elks are the ones that are doing it, and nobody wants to go after the elk here in Montana, Wyoming, and Idaho because it's such a revenue, they've changed the policy. Now, it's a case-by-case issue, and we've had two outbreaks again this year in Montana just this summer and fall alone. And now, if you have a case, it's an individual, the whole state doesn't lose it. They test each individual animal and only kill the ones that test positive. So even the consequence have changed, but yet the only animal that suffers the brunt of any of this is the buffalo. And why is that? Well, it's about public land grazing. It's about grass and who gets to eat it. And of course, you know, when you look into this a little bit further and you look into our public lands grazing system, I mean, here's yet another welfare project going on for the ranchers. Now, a cow-calf pair, and we're talking about a calf that's almost 6 months old, so they're almost a full-grown cow, get to be on our national forests for 3 to 4 months out of a year. And the price has varied since I first started, but I know they're not above $1.50 a month. And that $1.50 a month provides you with a fence system that's paid by the U.S. taxpayer, a road system that gets the cattle in and out, and a watering system, all this financed by the U.S. taxpayer. Well, that same price on private land is about $15 to $20 a month for a cow-calf pair. So you can see the huge, significant savings, and of course, they still have to do their road maintenance, their water, and their own fencing on those, so the cost is even worth way more. So, you know, why would the cattle industry want to change that beautiful program for themselves? And the more that the buffalo, like in the state of Montana, buffalo aren't even called wildlife. They're listed as an animal in need of disease control, and so they have absolutely no rights whatsoever. And these aren't Montanans' buffalo. These are the world's last buffalo. This is the last link we have to the 30 to 60 million, and that's why we're so outraged and think that this is an issue that pertains to all the states for sure, but all the world, really.
So just to be clear, because I think this may be shocking to some people, if I were a cattle rancher, and presumably a lot of these are not like, you know, somebody who has four cows just to feed themselves.
Right. We're talking about hundreds minimum.
Okay, so and it, yeah, so if I'm a big cattle rancher in Montana, I can put my cows on to public lands. This is not private lands, but public lands for something like, let's call it $1.50 per month. And the feds will provide, or feds or state, or the taxpayers in any case, will provide road access, fencing, water on public lands, and they will, the state then presumably will kill, or maybe the feds, I don't know, will either kill or push back off any bison who come onto those public lands, even though there has never been a case of transmission of brucellosis from bison to cows, and even though elk have brucellosis and there has been transmission, but they don't talk about that. Is this basically accurate?
Yes, without a doubt. And the fact, you know, on those grazing allotments, if a predator dares and comes eat one of your holy cow, they will euthanize the predators. They will provide a service that's just unbelievable. There is no risk whatsoever to these ranchers, or if there is a risk, there's an excessive compensation program that goes on.
So this sounds like a fabulous deal. How can everybody get in on this great cattle deal? I'm being ironic.
Unfortunately, you have to bid for the allotments, and a lot of times once they've been bid on, they keep those in their family for generations. You know, they don't want to get rid of them, and that's where we focus, is when they come up to the end of their time, we work with lawyers to try and get them shut down forever. We also work a lot with Western Watersheds Project, who is a phenomenal nonprofit that has shut down and closed down a lot of grazing allotments, and you know, in order to bring back the wildlife that was originally here and not sterilize our environment so that it is just accommodating for the holy cow.
So tell me first how you got involved with bison, and then after that tell me about the Buffalo Field Campaign work.
Well, I mean, my personal work, I used to travel the world, and I call myself a bit of a vidiot. And I used to do a lot of guerrilla media, sneaking into places, going and covering stories that our media never seemed to take time to cover. And in that process, you know, I'm from Montana. I've lived here for the last 32 years. And then someone asked me if I'd go down, if I'd heard about the bison issue. And I went down, and I kind of did everything I could. I got in, talked my way into a slaughterhouse. I talked my way into the capture facilities, and I put together a documentary that kind of got shown, especially to a lot of tribes. And I just decided that it was time for me to focus on one issue. And, you know, I have on video, like, me talking to those buffalo. I promise I'm going to do something for you guys, because all the groups that were working on it were working on 50 other issues. None of them were down here on the front lines. Really, they were just spouting the government word because they had no idea what was actually going on in the field and what they were seeing. And I also noticed that if I had a video camera out there, they wouldn't kill the big herd that I was standing with, and they'd just go kill some stragglers so it didn't look so bad, you know, and so we could make a difference if we were with all the buffalo that were out in the field. And so to date, we've had over 5,000 volunteers come with us and stand out in the field, and we basically are with these buffalo from sunrise to sunset. We're all armed with digital video cameras and still cameras. And our first and foremost goal is to show the world what's going on with these animals. But we've also grown throughout the years, and we lobby in D.C. We work on the state legislature. We're currently putting together the final scientific research to get these sacred animals listed as an endangered species so that they will have some protection. And, you know, but it's a beautiful campaign where we come here and we all learn to live together in this little cabin and go out in the field. And one thing, you know, being an activist for many years, especially in the animal rights movement, I've watched so many groups dissolve and fall apart over dietary issues and anything but what your vision truly is. And so here at our campaign, we call diversity our strength. And we honor and respect it. For instance, every night at our dinner table, we have a vegan meal. And we also have locally harvested wild game and fish out of the streams. And we don't support factory farms, but we feel it's more important to be self-sufficient. And, you know, when you have these vegan claims, a lot of times, too, the sad reality is Native Americans don't want to work with you, you know. That's to them, that's a very racist statement for them not to be able to eat the natural things that their people have been eating since time immemorial. And so we try to be conscious to all that. And we also realize that Native Americans are humans, too, and they make mistakes, and they're not all these perfect people either, and they get sucked into different things that maybe aren't good as well. But the whole thing is, if we can't work together and come together as a nation, then that 1% that the Occupy movement taught us so much about will just giggle as we infight amongst ourselves and never make a change in this world.
So you've had 5,000 people, you said, come through there?
We have in our last 16 years, yeah.
And so how many people would be there at a given time?
Any given time, we probably have between 15 and 25.
And how would someone go about, I know this is a question that's usually left for the end of an interview, but I want to do this now, and we still have a while to talk. How would someone go about, A, finding out more information about Buffalo Field Campaign, and B, how would someone who wanted to do something for the bison and they really wanted to come out, what would they do?
Okay. Well, our website is a plethora of information, and that's just simply www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And there's things you can do from afar, things you can do from, you know, everywhere, any way you want to get involved, and help, you know, write to your congresspeople, write to your senators, because a lot of your senators don't even know this is going on with the tax dollars, and the more education we can get local is always great. There's always tons of suggestions and the way people can always do it. Then if you'd like to volunteer, we have a short application that you fill out, and basically once that you fill that in, you have to pay to get here and to get home, and then we cater to every diet we possibly can, gluten-free, too, because that's become a huge thing in our world as well. And then we'll suit you up with great Patagonia gear as they sponsor us, and skis, snowshoes, get you out in the field, get you standing with buffalo, and that's about the gist of it. We haven't really said no to many people at all, and, you know, like I said, we really call diversity our strength, and we feel that the most important thing in activism in today's world is to learn how to live together again, to respect each other, to know how, you know, I'm sure you've witnessed this more than I have, Derek, but to me, a lot of activism is turning into activism is just criticizing other activists, and we're not doing anything in the field, and it just is so depressing when you know that there's a handful of us that care enough to do this for our life, and then other people have their criticism as their activism. It's just, we're our own worst enemies, and once again, referring back to the Occupy movement, that 1% just giggles at us because we're never pointing our finger at the right people. We're never fighting against the people that need it the most, and until we can see that ourselves, you know, we're going to do more breaking our arms, patting ourselves on the back, than being effective and changing things so that we leave something we can be honored about for our children and the next generations.
I completely agree with you. And so, I might have missed this. How long do people stay when they come to work with you usually?
Well, in the winter during the season, we ask for a minimum of 2 weeks, but you know, if you're like on a school schedule or in college and your vacations aren't long enough, we're happy to work with you that way. And like I said, a lot of people come out for 2 weeks and have been here 3 years, so it is rather addicting lifestyle, and I would warn you in advance that you may just get hooked on making change and hanging out with buffalo. And, you know, my naive personality thought I'd have this over in a couple years, and we're now entering our 17th year of doing this, but when you look at how deeply entrenched the cattle barons of the West are and how they manipulate and control everything, you start to understand that that change is a gradual thing. That change is something we have to be persistent. One of my favorite people in the world, Brock Evans, one of the authors of the Endangered Species Act, one of his mantras is endless pressure, endlessly applied. And I think that's what we all got to remember, that we can't just come do our one action and leave because that's what they hope for. We need to be there and be a persistent thorn in their butt and never give up until the change has occurred.
You know, I really like what you said a moment ago about how, you know, people might come for 2 weeks and end up staying for 3 years. That I don't know if I've told you the story of how I became an activist in the first place. That It all started because I knew everything was wrong, but I mean, there's so much that's wrong with this, you know, that's going on, and I didn't, but it's so big, and I didn't know what to do, so I didn't do anything. And then one day I realized, I was probably 25, I realized I wasn't paying enough for gas. I wasn't covering the ecological or social effects of gasoline. So I decided that for every dollar I spent on gasoline, I would pay myself, well, I would either give a dollar to a local environmental organization, or I'd pay myself $5 an hour to do activism. And it was the smartest decision I ever made, because so if I at that time in the 80s it would cost, you know, $10 to fill my tank. So if I spent $10 to fill my tank, I didn't have any money, so I couldn't donate it to anybody. So I would pay myself $5 an hour to do activism. And the point is that this was great because it allowed me to do it allowed me to do something, you know, to get off my behind.
Right.
And the cool thing is that after about 3 months I stopped keeping track because I was having so much fun with the activism that it was, you know, I could have bought a whole tanker of gas because I was doing way more than the 2 hours. And it just, you know, once I got started, once I had momentum, and I realized how much joy there is in working with other people to do good things, you know, it became my life.
Well, and it also lets you know you're not alone.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Sometimes I think that's the most important thing, is for us to understand we're not the only ones doing it and that there is support. And that's why I'm always so concerned about activists that call their activism criticizing other activists, because,
right.
I mean, and we see that way too much in our world. And I mean, to me, that's the chicken way out. To me, that's the not facing reality. Another thing that I've been talking about a lot, and because I'm, you know, just turned 52 and I'm kind of not as in on it on all the new tweets and blogs and, as I call them, McMe pages, you know, of activism. But those are unutilized tools. If we could quit talking about what you ate for lunch or where me and my friends are going, but say you walk by a stream that has some pollution in it, maybe taking a little video on your McMe phone of that and sending that out as your message of the day, that, hey, look what they're doing to our water in our backyard, you know, just using these tools of the day to educate and create change instead of just little gossip centers to promote yourself and your egos.
Well,
or your friends you've never met that are all of a sudden your best friends.
And that can, and once again, I think the important thing is to start. So a question I wanted to ask is what have you accomplished? And yes, there's, and I'm not in any way dismissing the lives of individual bison you've saved. That's all wonderful, and in no way am I demeaning that.
Right.
But in addition, what policy victories have you gained in the last 16 years? How is policy different now than it was 16 years ago? What is better and what is worse?
Well, I mean, the first one that is the most obvious is they no longer kill every single buffalo that takes a step outside of Yellowstone. They've conducted hazing operations for the last 10 years almost extensively, and hazing was never in the management plan, but because they're held accountable, because every move that they do in the field is seen by everyone, they've changed it. They're worried about their public image and their public, you know, reputation. I mean, also, just with education and outreach, one of the groups did a survey two or three years ago, and the outcome of it was 73% of all Montanans want live, free-ranging buffalo in the state. And, you know, when we started, that was hardly the situation. That was hardly so. I mean, we're getting to people. People are understanding it. And, you know, this is one issue. Like, I've worked a lot with issues that were just hated by everybody. And you're in the, you know, like Cove Mallard, Idaho, when we were protecting the forest there. Everyone in the neighborhoods and the communities looked at us as we're stealing their jobs. And so you really didn't have to go about doing activism with a conscience. It was more just doing actions that would shut down the actual operations, whereas this issue, most people agree with us. Most people are behind us. And so in that scenario, you really have to be conscious of what I say, you know, is like your actions can't turn people off to the buffalo. Like, I don't want ever to someone say, oh, I'm not going to be associated with BFC or Buffalo Field Campaign because I don't like what they do, so then I'm not going to like the buffalo because I don't want to be associated with the Buffalo Field Campaign. And that, I think, is something activists all around with all their issues need to look at. You know, I'm a firm believer in nonviolent direct action. I think it's a bit one of the most important tools we have, but understand that it can't be for your own self-gratification. It has to be to create a change down the road and create changing in people's opinions. And I have some elders in my community, and, you know, they discuss tactics with me of what would offend them, and I think that's an important tool for us to use. I mean, obviously, some issues you need to just do whatever you can, and we just got to stop it while it's happening. But there's other issues that do go for 17, 20 years that we have to take a long-term approach and look at it in that perspective as well.
So what is your I'm gonna use the word realistic, but you know we both know how the problems with that word. What is your realistic assessment of this particular issue over the next, say, 3 to 4 years? Do you see massive changes? Do you see more slogging? Do you see a sudden breakthrough?
Well, I know this year the population has grown. Like, one of the most silly things that this management plan does is put a population cap of 3,000 animals on the Yellowstone, or what is now referred to as the Yellowstone herd. Only we like to call it the Yellowstone Bison Reservation.
Right.
And the herd, at their estimate, is over 4,200 right now. So I know that they want to ideally kill a bunch of animals this year, and that will obviously make people stand up in many different ways, not so much, you know, maybe in a more arrestable scenarios, in the, being in the way, fighting for the buffalo's rights. And I think that when people see that even more, you know, our government's in such a financial crunch right now, as we hear redundantly, just because we have to have such an excessive military budget over feeding people and certain necessities. But I think that when people see that we're funding the Montana cattle industry, that my tax dollars, and the more we can pound that message out, and unfortunately the media shows up a lot more when a lot of buffalo die. So I mean, they're keeping the business as usual, but they have no incentive to rock the boat because they're getting $3 to $5 million from the government to run this program of federal tax dollars. And so they don't want to change it. They're ready to keep it rolling. And so I just think with time, with endless pressure, with, you know, constant keeping them liable and videotaping and showing people what they do, We're getting through. We're getting through to the messengers. And, you know, now we have a person that works with both us and Western Watersheds Project that's in D.C. at least 4 times a year and is talking to some people. And, you know, bipartisanship is a little easier reached when you're pointing out this waste of money that's going through the tube. So, you know, I don't know about having faith in humanity. I don't know about anything, you know, any drastic changes. I really thought the Gulf oil spill and that permanent video camera showing it spewing into the ocean might have made us jump up and be alarmed. So I don't know what what humanity needs now for their cattle prod to do something, but all we can do as we're conscious people is keep doing it, try new tactics, and work together with all our allies to create this change and never give up. I think that's the keyest message of it all, that we can't give up because these buffalo deserve it, and every other issue out there that people are fighting for deserve it as well.
So tell me, that's all really beautiful. And tell me, can you tell me a couple, three of your personally most extraordinary bison, I don't necessarily want to use the word experiences, bison interactions, bison, what are some of the most extraordinary things that have happened in your interactions with bison over the last 16 years?
Geez, where do you start? I mean, first off, just being in the field with them is such an honor. When you watch how the buffalo interact with one another, I mean, I just think they have so many lessons to teach humanity. When you watch, you know, the leaders, how they don't, you know, their job is just to make sure everyone in the herd survives, because in the buffalo world, everyone's as important as one another. But 2 years ago in the summer, I was really, you know, we had some interpersonal stuff go on here at the campaign, and I was really just judging myself. Oh man, am I making a difference? Are we doing anything good here? And it was July 2nd, and traditionally the buffalo are back in the park getting ready for the rut, you know, where they all kind of gather as the whole herd in the summer in August. And this one big bull buffalo came walking out, and we have this little 10-acre plot about 8 miles outside of Yellowstone Park. And this big boy walked into the neighborhood above ours. And, you know, when I say neighborhood out here, it's nothing like neighborhoods that most city people have. They're rather rural, but it's what we have. And unfortunately, up in this little neighborhood, this little annoying yappy dog that everyone in the neighborhood has been attacked by, and, you know, it's like one of those little chihuahuas, and this little naive four-legged being decided he was going to give this buffalo a hard time. So needless to say, this little yapping chihuahua learned how to fly. Now, it didn't get killed. It did get injured, and of course that warranted an immediate call to the Montana Department of Livestock. And so while they were coming out to deal with this rogue buffalo that had dared toss this chihuahua, this bull dropped down the hill, came walking into our yard, and for 12 and a half years I lived in a teepee year-round, and just a couple years back I moved into one of our cabins, and of all the places this buffalo could have gone in our entire ecosystem, he walked into where is my backyard and sat down right outside my kitchen window. So not 20 minutes later, here comes the Montana Department of Livestock, the Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, and the Gallatin County Sheriff, all in search in their own vehicles of this lone rogue buffalo. And the Fish, Wildlife, and Parks guy comes driving up to our property, and he's like, Mike, I got to tell you, there's this buffalo. It just gored a dog. We're looking for it. Have you seen it? I was like, oh, yeah. It came walking through here and walked down the valley, and you know, if you go down the road, you might find it. So they all left, and sure enough, they drove around for about 2.5 hours. As soon as they all left the scene, this buffalo got up from his nap and goes walking down where I said that he had gone. And sunset starts to come, and all of a sudden he comes walking back through our yard, and he goes up to where the neighborhood where he had, you know, gored that little chihuahua. And we followed it up and stayed, you know, with it until the sun went down and they wouldn't dare go up and shoot guns in the neighborhood. So the next morning it wandered another couple miles back towards the park, and they came out with a horse and an ATV, and I think they were trying to push it somewhere where they could shoot it out of the public eye. And the buffalo ran across Highway 287, jumped in Hebgen Lake, swam across, ran up Horse Butte, and has not been seen again to this day. And so that was a very touching story for me, and it came at a time when I needed some kind of comfort to, and, you know, I had two of my nephews here that I take for a week a year, like 13-year-old guys, and they're like, wow, Uncle Mike, those buffalo do really know where they're safe and protected. And that, you know, just a little thing like that can mean so much to someone like myself who has dedicated their life to hopefully make a difference for them.
And so the people who would come, I hate to make this too much of an ad for you getting people there, but what the heck.
Well, please, don't worry about that.
So, I mean, the people who would come there, they would get they would presumably see some bison. And then in addition, I mean, that's not the only animals. What made me think of this is when you were talking about the bison, there's a lot of bears here, black bears.
Right.
And I've had just over the last 10 years just extraordinary experiences and yes, they're wild beings, they're their own beings, they're not like dogs, but I've had extraordinary experiences with just bears either, well, sometimes they annoy the crap out of me, you know, when they knock over the worm bin or something, but other times I've just been so honored to be walking near. I mean, there was a bear. This is probably a terrible thing to say, but there was a bear who would I would walk down this path in the forest. There was a bear who would walk very close to me, and I always carried pepper spray because she's a big, huge animal. But she never did a thing. And,
right.
And so presumably, you've also seen. I mean, people who come there also see wolves or grizzly bears or
all
elk.
The above. I mean, of course, not the bears in the winter as they're hibernating, but yeah, I mean, on our daily patrols, and maybe I should break it down, like from November 15th until March, there's a bison hunt that goes on, and we don't unfortunately protest that mainly because it's a lot of Native American tribes being forced into hunting them for recognition of their treaty rights. But we do have Native tribal members on our board of directors and are working to get that to be a tool to turn around and sue these nations because they'll never be able to hunt them the way it's all being managed now. So after that becomes the hazing or capture season, and that goes from March until June. And then we're out in the field every day, you know, either monitoring, doing nonviolent direct action, trying to stop and slow down anything we can to protect the animals. Unfortunately, once again, when they haze, even though it's harsh and abusive, if we were to blockade or try and stop that, believe me, these guys are so vindictive, they would stop the haze in the tracks, pull out their guns, and start shooting them all, and then say, we tried to haze them, but because you get in our way, we're not going to allow this to happen. But in the capture, we obviously protest in many different forms or fashions. And then in the summertime, basically June through September, we do our education and outreach, because mainly the buffalo have been pushed back into the park, and there's 3 to 5 million tourists that have come here to see the buffalo, so they don't dare kill the buffalo when the 3 to 5 million tourists are here to bear witness. So those are kind of our seasons that we have here out in the field.
And that you said that in response to me saying that people also are going to, if somebody comes there to do this work, they will probably get to experience wolves,
Everyone has a story that's how I keep strong, is where I live has all the wildlife that were here when the conquerors came to this continent. We have wolves, grizzly bear, bobcat, lynx, fishers, everything. I mean, there is not a species that was on North America that isn't here, and we see them on a daily basis. We're out in the field with them, and yeah, I mean, just recently we had 4 wolves sighted last week. The week before they saw a pack of 2, and so we see wolves a lot this time of year as the winter doesn't give us our brothers and sisters the bears, but they come up with the awakening of the earth in spring, and then you have all the bird migrations. And, you know, that's the scariest thing, is Yellowstone ecosystem is one of 2 entirely fully intact ecosystems we have left in the lower 48 states. And here we have the Department of Livestock flying a helicopter 20 feet above the ground, and obviously you can't selectively pick one species to harass. You harass the entire ecosystem, and that's what we want to stop, too. We did shut it down because we got video footage of a grizzly bear getting caught in the haze, but our great judges of Montana threw it out of court this last year, and they were able to bring it back. But, you know, those are some of the things that you get just being out there, you know, that you got the footage that shut down the helicopter from being used. And so, you know, it's quite an experience, and anyone that I've ever met that's come here has honored me by saying it's changed their life. So I
have two questions. Left. One of them is a short question, then a sort of wrap-up question. The short question is, everything you're saying seems like it would be great for especially young people. What are some of the oldest people? What's the oldest person you've ever had who has come to help there?
Oh, we have elders. I have a guy right now, disabled vet running my maintenance program who's, 64 years old. So we have... That's the beauty of the Buffalo. We don't just attract Earth First activists. We attract all walks of life. All people are pulled to the Buffalo. We have Native American elders, Orville Looking Horse, who has been equated to the Pope of the Lakota Nation. The 19th carrier of the Sacred White Buffalo Calf Pipe comes here and does ceremonies with us. And so it's a wide dichotomy of the human race, but, you know, any age, younger, you know, usually if you're below a minor level, you have to get permission from your parents, but we've had some of those, and we've had elders in their 70s and 80s out here, so I can say...
So it's not just somebody who can snowshoe 15 miles a day.
Exactly, you know, and when you're in a tribe, when you're in a community like this, all jobs are just as important to keep the flow of the community going, and so everyone kind of has their niche and their place, and we try to find that and empower them to understand that it's all important in the existence of all of us to be able to work together, to be able to learn each other's wisdom and passion and share that. And, you know, my favorite thing is so many people have come here, learned what we do, and turned around and implemented and started their own campaigns where they live on issues that they care the world about. And that, to me, is the true form of activism, is teaching it so that it can be applied anywhere, because you can't turn your head one way and not see a problem in today's world.
Well, that's really my last question, and maybe you just answered it, which was, so somebody who, what do you want people who hear this interview to do? And let's say that for whatever reason they can't come out to Montana. I mean, it sounds to me like what you're saying is they should just turn their head to the side, see an issue, and then dive into it. Is that?
Well, I mean, that's the thing in today's world is, with all these tools, like we talked about earlier, social media, we have a voice and a platform right off the get-go. We just don't use it, you know? And, you know, I just ask anyone in today's world to look inside their heart, find the issue that motivates them that they can't stand seeing going on, and do something about it. Don't just sit back and be defeated. Understand that one person can make a difference. And you know, it's always been in the history of our world, it's always a handful of people that stand up and get the change created. And so be that person. Don't be afraid that, you know, I'm nobody different than anyone else, and I have the honor of standing with the Buffalo and help start this, but every person, every warrior that walks through this door, I'm standing next to one of my favorite ones in the world, Stephanie C., here, who runs our media campaign and kicks ass out in the field every day. And, you know, all of us can make this difference. And the thing is, if you don't, nobody will.
Well, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for being on this program.
Hey, Derek, thank you for inspiring the world and giving us a vision that we all need to follow. And I'm always honored to be in your presence, my friend.
Oh, thanks. Same to you. And thank you, everyone, for listening. And my guest today has been Mike Meese. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.